Good afternoon. Thank you, everybody, for being here on a wonderful, warm Wednesday, February 8th, 2023. We're here to have a discussion, and it looks like Chair Wicklund is online, and it looks like some other folks are online as well. Senator Matthews is online. And then we have one testifier online, I believe, Cherie Steele, is that correct? You can shake your head yes on that one. So what I'll probably do is, given the fact we have just one provider online, Musab and Andre, maybe instead have her go first, or do you guys want to present your, knowing Musab Khalif, you probably have a bunch of data sheets you're going to share with us. Is that correct? Because this gets to the heart of the conversation. It's like, first of all, we are grateful that we're in this position so we can have this conversation because, you know, I want to say that it's going to be important for us just going forward. What does that mean for next, right? So we want this to be a productive conversation, and I would hope that it doesn't become one of projecting, well, John Hoffman, you said this, and will you promise, you know what I mean? I want it to be about, here's where we're at, this is what's going on, here's where we need to be, how can we get there kind of thing, right? And I think somewhere in between, you know, you're going to have information and data that will help, you know, solidify, validate, maybe not validate, whatever. The point is, let's keep it focused on the matter at hand. So, Why don't we do this? Because I have Musab and Andre. Why don't you guys come up and then Cherie, Ms. Cherie Steele, you can go up after those guys. Laura Perfirst, I hope I said that right. Anna Buchanan, and then Olga Shavileva, and then God, I'm just really bad at this. That's okay. People still can't get my last name right. They say Huffman or Houtman, but they can't say Hoffman. And then Tavana Johnson. And then I want to have a conversation afterwards. And when this is all done, hopefully it'll allow our committee to really get into a conversation about, okay, so what does this mean, right? That's what I want to get to. You know, so what does this mean? And maybe Elise Bailey, Christy Grom, and you know, we can come up and we can have this, so what does it mean next conversation kind of things. Does that seem fair to people? Are you guys okay with that? Everybody's shaking their head yes? Okay. So Andre Best, Musab Khalif, welcome to the committee. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Andre Best. I am the Vice Chair for the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. I'm also the CEO at Best Care. We provide PCA waivered and FMS services, and I'm here with my colleague.
My name is Musab Khalif. Hello, Senator and Mr. Chair as well. I work for Midwestern Healthcare, and I'm a proud member of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. And I'm here with Andre, and today we'll be telling you about the implications of the reimbursement rate and wages. So Andre will start us off.
Yes. First of all, thank you so much for your time today. And as we all know, we're here to talk about these wage and reimbursement increases and what they mean. First of all, we wanted to give you a little background on the PCA program the way it is today. We are serving 44,000 recipients, and notably, 63% of those are from BIPOC communities. Also, there are 60,000 PCAs, and 80% of those individuals are women and or from BIPOC communities. The chart you see on the right is another way to break down the communities themselves by ethnicity of the people we serve. As we all know and why we're here, PCA is one of the lowest reimbursed programs in the state, and our current rate is $19.60 an hour. It's much lower than other services that are similar in nature. For example, under DWRS, individualized home supports without training is reimbursed at $33.84. Similar service, it's 71% higher than our current PCA reimbursement rate. Snapshot about the agencies themselves. As of the end of last year, 12/31, there were 924 PCA agencies enrolled. Below that is the most recent data we have from 2018. At that time, the median enrollment, this is how long PCA agencies were enrolled with the state, was 5 years. And that ranged from less than a year to 30 years. There was also a median of 54 PCAs affiliated with each agency. That's the number of PCAs that actually work for that agency. So the point is 67% of all agencies serve less than 50 people. They're small. The majority of the agencies are small, and they do not have the capacity to absorb large losses. Okay, before we say any of this, we should say we fully support higher wages for PCAs and benefits. We all want the same thing. However, the problem is the reimbursement rate included in the governor's budget is not adequate to cover the cost of this increase. Wages and benefits included in the tentative SEIU collective bargaining agreement, and that's why we're here. And all this poses a problem for recipients, for agencies, and in our opinion, the program itself. So what the budget says, the tentative collective bargaining agreement would increase the base wage by $3.75 on January 1st, 2024, and then another dollar on January 1st, 2025, for a total increase of $4.75. The governor's budget, alternatively, has proposed to increase the reimbursement rate by only $3.32 on January 1st of 2024, then another $1.16 on January 1st, 2025, for a total base wage increase of $4.48. Now, the problem is, well, in addition to the base wages, agencies are also responsible to pay benefits and employer taxes that equal 13.48%. 51% on top of the base wage for 2024 and 64 cents on top of the base wage for 2025. So when you account for wages, benefits, and taxes, the budget is 94 cents short per hour for 2024 and 91 cents short per hour for 2025. And when you look at the operating expenses, the shortfall is even greater. And Musab is going to talk a little bit about that now.
Mr. Musab Khalif.
Oh, not yet, right?
Not yet.
But, well, the reason... Well,
I heard you segue into that. You don't tell an old drummer that now we're going to do this. It's like saying, all right, now the guitar player is going to do a solo, and then I go and hit the cymbal, and, of course, he wasn't doing the solo. So, you know, let's try that again. Why don't you just start all over?
I'll go back. Okay. When you look at the operating expenses, the shortfall is even greater. And the reason we know this is because of this survey that we have, 80 providers conducted by the Alliance. And the results of that survey show that taxes insurance, 10.15% of the base wage. That's insurance, FICA, FUTA, SUTA, Medicare, workers' compensation, those kinds of things. Then the employer-related benefits, PTO, holiday pay, 3.33% of the base wage. Then agencies, the cost to provide this service, the operating expenses, are an additional 10%. And Musab is going to elaborate on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Khalif.
So what are some of our other expenses? As you see up there is a list of administrative staff costs, qualified professional costs, EVB, but I would like to highlight the background studies cost. We recently found out that that will increase from $42 to $44. So given our current profit margins, it will take about 17 hours to recover that cost. When it goes to $44, it will take us 20.5 hours to recoup that cost. Now you might be wondering to yourself, are there margins that bad? Or is this cost that high? I would say both. Next slide. Here you can see the increases in our wages versus the increases in our reimbursement rate. If you account for the proposal for 2024 and 2025, that increase over time has been 86% for our wages. In the same time, our reimbursement rates have only increased 41%. That is a 45% difference, or more than two times faster, that our wages have increased. Next slide.
Can you go back?
Yeah.
Go back. Explain that.
So this is chart basically showing the increases that we've, every time we had an increase, right? Year over year, right? We added all those increases up for our wages, and we added all the increases that we had for our reimbursement rates, right? And overall, our reimbursement rates have increased 41% from 2015. And for our wages, they have increased 86% since 2015.
Thank you, Mr. Khalif. That explains that first issue or concern of the gap, the closing gap. Okay, that's, and this is for the providers that you survey. These are the providers in the PCA reimbursement rate providers. Are these all across the state that you did the survey on?
No, this number is for everyone right here. This reimbursement rate increase and wage increase is across the board because it's coming from the governor and the department.
Okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Khalif. Go ahead.
So now let's talk about the 72.5 rule. We've heard a lot about that rule. That rule basically stipulates that we must spend 72.5% of our reimbursement rate on wages and benefits. But you will soon see we've been much greater than that so far. And in 2024, that will become 94.1%. Let me clarify. We will spend 94% of our reimbursement rate in 2024 on wages and benefits. That will leave 5.9% gross margin, not profit margin, gross margin for us to cover our expenses. That is rent, utility, overall operating expenses, administrative overhead, SG&As more broadly speaking, 5.9%. When we say this program is in crisis, that's what we're talking about here. Next slide, please. So this slide is going to basically talk about this problem in real dollar terms. So Senator Hoffman, you asked me about what does it mean when I say wages have increased 86%. So you can see on the top bar.
I can't because those are really. All right, now I can. Khalif, go ahead.
Sorry about that.
You're good.
You can see that our wages have increased. So in 2015, our total labor cost was 12.05. And by 2024, they will be 21.56, total labor cost, right? So that's the increase we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Similarly, on the other hand, our reimbursements were 17.08 in 2015, and they've increased to 22.91. So if you take the total labor cost that's above right there, that 21.56, and divide it by the 22.91, that's the margin that we're talking about, or that's the 94.11% we're talking about that will go to total labor cost, total direct labor cost. That leaves us with a margin of negative 4.1% once we account for operating cost. That means every hour, we lose 94 cents. Every hour of work we do, we lose 94 cents. Tell me, who can stay in business at that? How can we serve our clients at that rate? We're losing money. Every hour, we can't keep going at that rate. Next slide, please. When we speak about firm closures with the department, they always say to us that there's more companies starting every year. Nobody's disputing that the barriers to entry in the PCA market are low. To get all you have to do to start is basically get a contract with the state. What we are saying is the cost of staying in business is high. That's the story we're talking about here when we say we make negative 94 cents per hour. So what's a better thing to look at is the closures year over year. And as you can see here, it's going up and up and up. In 2022, 41 PCA agencies closed. Next slide, please. When Andre started out this presentation, he talked about how the majority of clients are served by small firms. We take pride in those firms and their diversity. Those firms are the most closest to the communities that their clients are in. They share the same language, culture, and they are probably the most apt to serve those clients. But we are seeing those are the ones that are closing down. That leaves our clients with less choice. And if this new proposal is to go through, well, the entire program is gone. And these clients will then have to leave their homes, leave their loved ones, and go to institutional-based care. When I hear that, I think to myself, why are we doing this? Makes the state get more cost? Our clients don't benefit? Who benefits from this? Next slide, please. So how do we solve this problem? What can we do? Well, first, to maintain our current margins. And as I've already said, they're not good, but to maintain them, in 2024, the reimbursement rate will need to be $24.42. The governor's proposal says it's $22.91. For 2025, we will need to have a reimbursement rate of $25.70 to keep our current margins, where the governor's proposal is saying $24.08. But our current margins is what's causing 41 companies to shut down, 41 small firms to shut down. So to truly solve this problem, we should fund the framework fully. When I say that, what I mean is in Senate File 7, Article 4, the implementation component should be made 100%, and that will yield a price or reimbursement rate of roughly $27.95 or $27.14, around that range. Now, that is not going to be as high or close to the increases that we've had in wages, but it will make us sustain and it will keep the program from collapsing. Thank you so much for your time, and we're here to answer any of your questions.
So, members, any questions for Mr. Khalif or Mr. Best? I do know you cited your sources in your handout as well. So, this is data that you had put together, and aren't you getting some master's degree from someplace on this kind of data stuff?
Mr. Yes, Khalif? I finished my MBA at the University of Minnesota. Yes,
you did. Thank you. So, members, any questions? Senator Makewade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for missing the very beginning. I was finishing up a meeting, and so you might have covered this. And if you did, you can tell me, and everyone will know, and you can stop. But can you describe to me the kind of work that PCAs do? Because I'm looking at 2442 and 2570, and I'm wondering what kind of work does a PCA do for that amount of money?
Mr. Best.
PCAs are really integral to a lot of people's lives, and it varies depending upon the need of the person. And we serve anyone from 1 year to 101 years old. So everybody's got a different set of needs, but they might be helping people get dressed, bathe, move from the couch to the bed, get to work, get to the doctor's office. Remind them to take their medications, redirecting behaviors that people might have.
I would also add, for our enhanced clients, you would need to change their bandages.
Wound care.
Sometimes you will need to feed them, right, through if they need that kind of support, right, through a tube. But let me put it to you this way. When we didn't have a client receive the caregivers that they were supposed to have last time, he ended up dying. And his family ended up here testifying and telling us that we should fix this. It broke my heart that day. It broke all of our hearts that day. This is life or death we're talking about here. It's not... Sorry, I'm a bit emotional here.
That's okay, Mr. Khalif. Just, you know, to Senator Makewade's point, she asked about what services they provide. I'm with you. I'm sick of the thoughts and prayers comments about our most vulnerable folks, and we want them to live in the community, right? I mean, this is why we're here having this conversation. Grateful that the PCA structure, you know, grateful that the spotlight's on, right? I mean, thank you to the governor for putting the spotlight on. let's make it better, right? I mean, this is all we're doing. So, Senator Makewade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll confess I knew the answer to that question, but I think it's important for the record to hear the very important, critical, life-affirming, intimate care that PCAs provide, and in context with this, too, because, you know, when I think about wound care and feeding someone and helping getting them to the bathroom and the kind of relationship you have to build for that, that's the amount of money that I would want to make to do that, the amount of money I would want to pay somebody to do that, it's more than this. And so I wanted that to be on the record, and I completely understand the emotion, but I confess it was to put it there and not because I didn't know. And I appreciate you coming in to shine that light.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Fateh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you both for your presentation. On the previous slide, or the slide before that, you showed 41 providers shut down. So can you tell us what happens to those clients? And if this continues, what would happen to the folks that are now receiving those services?
Mr. Best?
Again, it depends on a very situational kind of thing. Sometimes providers will shut down, not give people adequate notice, and people will be calling around trying to find an agency.
Mr. Best, can you speak into the mic, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sometimes people won't get adequate notice that their agency is shutting down, and they'll be calling around trying to find someone in the last minute, and their workers have to be enrolled with the new agency before they can even start working. So sometimes it'll result in a gap in care for those people. And everything in between, and sometimes it goes great, but most of the time, especially when an agency is closing, it's not.
Senator Fateh.
So in that gap of care, what happens when a client has immediate needs, like needing their bandages changed, needing help with the restroom? Where do they go,
Mr. Best?
Sometimes those people end up in the hospital or a facility. If they're vulnerable and they're not able to care for themselves and they're in danger, then they'll end up in a hospital or some kind of facility.
Senator, thank you. Yeah, no, you're at the point. So thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for thank you for your testimony. And we're going to have some work. This will be what's next. So, you know, don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere for a while. I mean, you can leave now, but I mean, don't.
Thank you.
Thank you guys honestly so much.
Don't run over to the other body building and, you know, and try to talk to anybody. I mean, just stay here. So, Ms. Cherie Steele, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Cherie Steele. I am the owner of Hope Care PCA, Inc. I started about 13 years ago. I'm a small, intimate agency taking care of about 40 elder and disabled clients. Being a smaller agency have allowed me to have a little more personal relationships with my clients and customers. Sadly, I am currently in the process of shutting the business down. I should have closed a little sooner, to be honest, but I continue to hold out hope that realistic reimbursement rates will happen, or I can continue to be creative on how to continue doing the work that I love in our community. The years of underfunded and PCA reimbursement has finally been too much for me to stay open. I had to stop offering choice services a few years back because I couldn't continue paying higher wages, holiday pay, PTO, under traditional services. I'm currently paying a slightly lower rate with the benefits of PTO and holiday pay. Has allowed me to stay open a little longer. Unfortunately, even with the 10% reimbursement legislation passed last year, it came years too late, much too late. And it was just enough after so many years of underfunding that it only went up like 0.24 per year over the past 14 years. It's just been a struggle for us. Providers have been sounding the alarm regarding to continue shortfall with the reimbursement rate year after year, but no one is listening to us. Why is that? I don't know. I really would like to know what that means for us. I did not fail as a business owner. The state has failed the vulnerable PCA providers, me included. Thank you. And I would just like to note that I am concerned about where we're going, where the PCA provider services are going. I feel very, very, I have mixed emotions about what happens to my people that I've been caring for the past 13 years. and I struggle to understand where the program is headed, because as it looks right now, it doesn't look positive for us, and it doesn't look positive for the people that we provide the services to. If there's something that DHS is trying to do to change the way that we deliver the services, I really would like to know so that the providers are aware, because we're all concerned. Thank you for allowing me to speak today, and good day.
Thank you, Ms. Steele. Thank you for your input. I'm sorry that to hear that you are leaving a much-needed service, and please note that. Thank you for your testimony. Laura Perfirst, did I get that right? I hope you correct me. Anna Buchanan, I know I can't mess that one up. Why don't you come on up and come on down. You're the next contestant. And then Olga, I'm not even going to do that because you're going to correct me when you come down after that. So why don't you, Ms. Perfirst?
Perfest. But you're close.
I was close. Tell us, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Hoffman and committee members. My name is Laura Perfirst. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of LifeWork Services. Thank you for holding the hearing today to hear about PCA services and for this opportunity to testify. LifeWorks is a nonprofit organization that was founded by parents back in 1965. We are also members of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. LifeWorks has been providing PCA Choice services since 2003 and currently provides PCA Choice services to just under 500 individuals throughout the state of Minnesota. In addition to PCA Choice Services, LifeWorks is also a financial management service provider, also known as an FMS, where we help people directly employ their own service workers. We also provide some 245D basic and intensive services as well. So all in all, serving about 300 of people with disabilities throughout the state. LifeWorks chose to serve and chose to only provide PCA Choice Services as we have a belief in self-direction that aligns with our mission and how we partner with people with disabilities. LifeWorks has always supported higher wages and benefits for PCA workers, and we truly appreciate all the work that has been done to achieve the incremental wins that we've gotten thus far for these critical Minnesota workers who help people maintain their independence. I want to share with you some of the findings from my own financial analysis relative to the provisions in the tentative collective bargaining agreement and the subsequent rate increases included in the governor's budget. So all in all, there just appears to be a misalignment between the reimbursement rates and there appears to be a misalignment between reimbursement rates paid to providers and the associated costs providers must pay based on the collective bargaining agreement. I included for you all today a document for this hearing, which includes my findings. But just to highlight a few things, the historic PCA rates that have existed, they existed before the PCA workers were covered by a collective bargaining agreement. So we just believe that there's some misalignment in how those increases are determined that are required to cover the collective bargaining agreement components. So my analysis concluded that providers will now be required to fund about $4.61 for every hour worked by PCAs, and that providers' gross margins will erode, continue to erode, they've been eroding for the last several years, to less than 1%, and that will be what's left for providers to cover their administrative costs. Transitioning to the new CFSS reimbursement rates, that language is found in Minnesota Statute 256B851, there will be additional challenges for providers. My analysis concluded two components that I wanted to just draw your attention to in the language in that statute. The first one is the methodology to determine the base hourly wage. It's going to conflict with the hourly wage being negotiated in these collective bargaining agreements. The other piece is the implementation component factor written in the statute's language as well, which is stating it will only reimburse 75.45% of the calculated CFSS reimbursement rate. So once the 15-minute rate is determined, it will then be discounted to 75.45% of that resulting rate. So this will lead to even leading to a full erosion of any provider margin. And in fact, if you look at the information I provided, there just won't be any financial resources to continue operations. It will be a negative gross margin. So we're asking for rate increases that will be aligned with the cost of providing the services, and an increase that will also acknowledge the losses providers have already absorbed from the collective bargaining agreements, including the new provisions in the tentative agreement. So how does this impact us? If we're not able to achieve alignment between the reimbursement rates and the required worker cost minimums, LifeWorks, as well as other providers, will need to continue to reassess viable business and financial models. We might be forced to make some tough decisions, which ultimately will impact the person using the PCA services and the workers who provide that support. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Perfeast. Any questions for our friend from LifeWorks?
Nope.
Anna Buchanan, welcome.
Hi. Chairman Hoffman and the committee here.
Can you get closer to the microphone for me, please?
Sorry about that.
Thanks.
Hello, Chairman Hoffman and committee members. I've been in the business for about 28 years. I started as a PCA for my uncle, favorite person in the world. He'd bring me bags of candy. He was a brain trauma patient that was requested to leave a nursing home. And we called on a holiday, and this company accepted us. And they couldn't find caregivers either. So I was one of the caregivers. And I learned to duck when he'd swing because he was a brain trauma patient. I learned how to feed him. I learned how to transfer in a wheelchair. I got into this business because it was family. I've been doing it for 28 years, like I said. I'm the administrator for Heartland PCA. We have 382 clients, 443 employees. We've grown through the years. And my heart goes out to all these clients that have been with us for years. And if you think about your grandmother or somebody special to you that needs care, where are they going to go? I called nursing homes. I checked with other places when I started struggling with how are we going to stay in business. When we stopped taking choice clients because we couldn't do that. That's where I started. I was one of those employees. I worked three jobs to make sure I could still do it. But this industry is in trouble. A lot of people are looking at closing. We put family money in to keep this going. I wake up every day with, 900 people on my mind. How do I save this business? I'm begging you. We need to do something. It's not about the employees. It's about the reimbursement. We could get employees if we could pay a living wage. I learned to do the medical cares. I've done the feeding tubes. I've done the baths. I've done the Hoyers. This is a medical service. This is needed. People need it, and they cannot be left without. Last week, we got a call from a gentleman. Please, can you help me? It's been a month since I've had a shower. That's something you guys can relate to. Go for a month without a shower. Put yourself in their shoes. These are the kind of phone calls we get. I'm new at this. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do when I get up here. But honestly, this industry is in trouble. People are in trouble, and I don't know where to send my clients. I can't keep doing this.
You're new at this, but I'll tell you what, the most impactful new thing, right, is to tell your lived experience, and you just did that. And this is what we're about here in this committee as well. And thank you for sharing that. It's hard to share, but you did you did better than I did the first time I testified in front of a hearing. So I actually ran out of time. Imagine that. But yeah, Senator Utke, I did. Because I didn't know what I was doing. I just kept talking. But what you did was just you told the real story. Why? I asked at the very beginning of this session, right? Why do we do this work? To get us to the why, right? You just explained the why, right? And that's what I asked for. That's what you just did. You delivered. You did a nice job. And you know what? This committee is committed to making sure that we get things right in Minnesota. And now is the time to do it, right? And everybody at this table concurs with that. That's why they asked to be on this committee, right?
Right. Everybody's here because they have a reason they're here. So what can we do to help you get what we
need? We can talk about that. So afterwards, you want to follow up with about what needs to be done? Absolutely. Have lots of things. So, you know, we'll get to that. Thank you, you two. Olga Shevaleva and Tavana Johnson. And actually, yeah, Rick, you guys want to wait or do you want to come up now? Or yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah, well, you can come on up. And then maybe that'll segue us into, I don't know. Yeah, we'll get any. So thank you, you guys. I think we'll do this. Ms. Shevaleva, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Hoffman and committee members, my name is Olga Shevaleva Bomberger, and I am the VP of Development and Strategic Planning at Metropolitan Community Services. Our agency is a nonprofit, multi-specialty, essential community provider established about 10 years ago. We serve around 300 people in our PCA program. We're a culturally specific provider specializing in the Eastern European population. Majority of our staff are bilingual and very well versed in cultural aspects of our clients' daily lives. I also serve on the board of directors for the Minnesota Home Care Association, a statewide association of organizations providing a wide spectrum of home-based care services to older Minnesotans and those with disabilities and complex health conditions. Our state is facing a workforce crisis impacting access to PCA services. A growing number of Minnesotans without access to home care services are turning to more intensive, expensive, and currently overstressed facility-based care such as hospitals and other long-term care settings. If the legislature passes into law new wage and benefit requirements, such as those contained in the state's tentative agreement with SEIU, without the sufficient level of funding to pay for those new compensation levels, the Minnesota's PCA service system will crumble. As an example, for an average agency to pay $19 an hour wage, the agency must pay additional $3.68 an hour to cover basic benefits and payroll expenses, and another $3.60 an hour to afford its administrative costs and overhead. With that in mind, the minimum reimbursement rate should be at least $26.28 an hour for a PCA agency to be able to pay the $19 an hour wage. Following the same logic, the minimum reimbursement rate for a $20 an hour wage must be at least $27.72 an hour. There currently is an established requirement of 72.5% of the reimbursement to be allocated to wage and benefits. It closely reflects the calculations that I just mentioned. Unfortunately, with these higher but still limited rates, PCA agencies will remain unable to compete with the other employers in similar industries in terms of employee benefit packages, leadership training, and career development from within. In this light, the proposed reimbursement rate of $22.92 in year one and $24.08 in year two will result in underfunded difference of $3.36 an hour in year one and $3.64 an hour in year two. I believe you have the handout on this. I tried to make it very visual.
No, you did. You did. It actually is easy to read for me. There you go.
Good. I am asking this committee to engage with stakeholders and DHS to re-examine the assumptions and calculations behind the rate increases associated with the new bargaining agreement. The work that PCAs do is incredibly rewarding and challenging. PCAs provide the critical supports that enable individuals to live healthy lives and as independently as possible from the comfort of their home. These valued employees deserve to be paid a fair wage and receive appropriate benefits. I greatly appreciate the legislature's focus on strengthening the PCA program in recent years. Please work with us to ensure that we are strengthening access to PCA services and therefore better supporting Minnesotans to live in the most cost-effective environment. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. And this is a, Senator Hoffman, this is a really good presentation you put together here, and I appreciate the in-depth, and I think the committee and I keep to learn understand this more and more, and that's helpful. Ms. Shevaliva, if I said that right. So I'm going to ask the next group the same question. So, but I presume you're a non-union shop, is that right?
Non-union, yeah, okay. Very traditional.
No, that's fine. It's not a pejorative. I'm just asking. And so is there a range of pay in your PCA crew? Are they all at the same lower number, or do you have some higher paid people as well?
Ms. Shevaliva.
Hey, apologize.
That's okay.
Unfortunately, we have to keep everyone at the same rate, and we get this question asked a lot from our employees, and we look really bad when we say there's zero margin for us to go higher.
Just if you don't mind saying, what is your current rate that people get?
Ms. Shevaliva.
The regular range, the regular rate is $14.25 an hour, and for the enhanced rate, we're able to pay $7.50. I believe at this point, we just go up to $15.25 is what we're able to afford for the enhanced. So for people who go through extra training and care for individuals who have 10 or more hours. Yeah. And thank you very much for passing that. It used to be 12. Now we can expand it a little bit more. And surprisingly, at 12 hours, we didn't have a lot of people because it's very complex individuals on ventilators and very, very specialized care. But with 10 hours and more, it is a much wider range of people who absolutely need, who have multiple caregivers, who absolutely need the care as well. So that was very helpful.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Adler. Thank you. Ms. Tavana Johnson.
Chair Hoffman and members of the committee, my name is Tavana Johnson. I'm here to testify on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents over 50,000 healthcare workers across the state, including workers in hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes. I am part of the largest unit, which covers almost 27,000 self-directed home care workers, including PCAs and family caregivers. Workers in self-directed programs like me are hired and supervised by our clients, but we negotiate with the state of Minnesota for our contracts that covers our wages and benefits. There is another group of about the same size called traditional PCAs. They are employees of private agencies and are not covered by our contract, but get the same reimbursement rate. I provide care in the homes of members of my community in Austin, Minnesota. The work I do is incredibly important to me and most important for the people that I care for. Doing the work I do means that clients I care for can live in their own homes, living the lives they choose. It saves the states thousands upon thousands of dollars because they are not in nursing homes or long-term care facilities. I maintain their households by running their daily errands, which includes groceries, bankings, bill drop-offs, and pharmaceutical pickups. I cook nutritious meals and make sure their homes are clean, safe environments. I also provide personal care such as bathing, dressing, and some clients might require me to even feed them, amongst many other duties and tasks. Home care has been facing a workforce crisis for a long time, and COVID only exacerbated that. It breaks my heart to know that people are going without care, so I find myself working as many hours as I possibly can manage just to ensure that as many people as possible in my community can receive services and get the care they need. I am incredibly proud of the tentative agreement we reached with DHS and MMB. Our contract is a huge step towards solving the crisis. I want to thank Governor Ross and his administration for working with us and being a part of this historic opportunity. Our contract agreement includes minimum wage increase from $15.25 an hour to $19 an hour by January 1, 2024, and up to $20 an hour by January 1, 2025. $1,000 bonus for workers who have worked 6 months in the bargaining unit to help address the issues of retaining workers, and a wage scale for experienced workers to be able to keep the people who have been doing this work the longest and enjoy it the most in the field instead of leaving for better paying jobs with more better benefits. We also won the ability to shape an orientation program with DHS that will help professionals in this industry. New workers will have the chance to start with more than just an internet video and an online test. The contract will change my life. With a $20 an hour wage, I can afford to solely support myself and do the work that I love and I feel that I have a God-given talent for. I also want to point out that this contract also corrects an historic injustice. Healthcare work is disproportionately done by women and people of color. For that reason, this industry has for generations been excluded from basic labor protections. This has led to decades of low wages and underfunding. We must correct this, and this contract is a good start. I also want to address the question about whether DHS has accurately predicted the cost of our contract. To start, our union wants DHS to accurately predict the cost of the contract, and we would gain nothing if DHS were to underfund this contract. The funding cost in this is a technical issue, and we rely on DHS to get it right. Some providers have first raised this issue. We have encouraged DHS to take their concerns seriously, and we have helped set up meetings at which these issues were discussed. We are glad that this year DHS made a small adjustment to their calculations. We still think, however, that this is an open-ended question whether their calculations provide sufficient funding to pay for the full value of the wage increases in our contract. For context, it's important to remember that in 2021 session, the legislature approved an additional PCA rate increase beyond what was necessary to fund our contract. I urge legislature to dig into the details of the total cost I urge legislators to dig into the details of how the total cost is calculated, because it is a lot of money and the consequences of getting it wrong could be serious. If they think there is a better way to calculate the cost, we would support funding to more accurately project the cost. If legislature thinks more money is needed, we recommend for transparency and tracking that the additional money be used to adjust the calculation of the DHS cost projection. That way, you'll know what you're paying for. To close, we are so incredibly grateful that we are here talking about this historical, life-changing agreement. This contract truly is life-changing for the people that do the work and the people that we care for. In the past, we have been able to do this work because of the bipartisan support we had in legislature. I look forward to continuing that during this legislative session and many more ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, and to Ms. Johnson or Mr. Rocco. Is there a range of what PCAs get under the employees in your contract? It sounds like you start out, there's the base part. Is there any like higher paid PCAs at the top of a scale somewhere?
Chair Hoffman, Senator Abler, Rick Varco with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. You are correct that our contract is a little unusual, in which the principal feature is a minimum wage. There are people who make more than that minimum wage. That is an important part of the DHS calculation and about the total cost of the contract, because there's a difference between the impact of the minimum wage, which might only affect some people, versus people above the minimum wage where there might not be an impact. But DHS would have the best numbers on that.
So, Senator Ayler, thank you, Mr. Varco, and maybe Ms. Shevaliva, maybe if we can make room. This is a great conversation. This is where I wanted to go with this, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly, right? How do you get to this rate? How do you get to that rate? I'm not a math person, sociology, not math. You want to talk chi-square?
Superior to the finance chair of a $30 billion budget.
I know, but I can understand this. And this is where the smartest person in the room, I think, needs to come. Is Christy Graham coming down, too, or not? No, stay here, Rick. I mean, this is. I think this is where we need. This is a great conversation. Because you know, I've heard the fully fund. I've heard the rate. I heard, oh my God, it was like going back in time. I heard rate methodology. I started having conversations. Are we going to do the DWRS? Are you going to look at a full impact or the full thing of it? But I mean, just that conversation that just happened. What are your thoughts? I mean, as you're looking at this, you know. Your thoughts on that, please, Ms. Bailey. Thank you for being here, by the way.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services. And I'll get to the question in a minute, but I'd just like to thank the committee for talking about this really important topic. And we feel at the administration that... you know, the governor and the lieutenant governor really prioritize these workers and are really excited about this historic agreement that in the budget it's almost $800 million of state dollars and over $1.5 billion, including federal funding. And so this is a big priority of the governor and lieutenant governor, and we're excited to talk about it. So I think to go into the details of the DHS calculation, it really, really does speak to the question Senator Abler asked about what are the current wages that the workers in this bargaining agreement get paid currently. So these workers are about a quarter of the total workforce in PCA across the state. And when we calculate the impact of a floor, we look at every single worker that are that is included within the bargaining agreement. As of August 2022, it was about 28,000 workers. And we know what their wage was paid in that pay period. And we calculate the difference between that wage and what the floor would be. So that means that if people are already making above the new floor, we do not anticipate a wage increase for them in this contract. It would be different if the question was, what would be the cost if everyone went up by X percent? That math calculation would be quite different. But with this bargaining agreement, it is really calculating the difference between one floor to another floor. And if somebody already makes higher than the new floor, we don't anticipate increased costs as a result of the bargaining agreement. And so that's why you're seeing a discrepancy between, say, a bill that may increase the framework, as the Provider Alliance discussed, and what the cost of the bargaining agreement would be. We do think that those two things could work well together. It doesn't mean that the legislature, you couldn't choose to increase the rates even further. And it also doesn't mean that we don't disagree that the provider margins may be quite slim, because we do calculate it on a statewide average, and the impact to each individual provider may differ depending on how much they pay right now and how much they're needing to go up to with their particular workforce. And so we're happy to be here to be part of the solution. And we truly believe this workforce is critical, critical, critical to ensuring that people are able to stay in their own homes and work in their workplaces and really live the lives that they want to. And this workforce makes that happen.
Yeah. Senator Abler,
I don't want to monopolize
anything. No, you're not monopolizing, but I think this gets to that. You know, where, because, you know, to see where it's like 94%, all of a sudden you start to see these numbers and it's like, you know, help us understand. And if it means, you know, what does that mean for us as a committee, you know, getting more money, trying to get more money, trying to put more money into there, how we're going to do that, right, kind of thing. So that's, my mind is just thinking about that because I'm looking at those margins and I'm thinking, interesting. This doesn't make sense to me. So, Senator Abler.
Well, and I really appreciate coming down. Mr. Varco, said Mr. Chair, Mr. Varco, I finally understand how the math works. Ms. Johnson is going to, if you're at the bottom level, you're going to get a raise to $19 and $20, which is really good. And it isn't really important to me necessarily what people are getting at a higher number than that, and we could discuss that, but that's just going to confuse the matter. But are those workers aware they're not going to get any increase, even for inflation? Mr. Varco.
Mr. Varco.
Chair Hoffman, Senator Abler, yes, we've got a negotiating team that talks to our membership and has fully informed them about the negotiating process. There are other benefits in the contract that are captured in the cost projections that aren't included in the minimum wage. I think over time, more and more people have been, I think it's fair to say more and more people have been captured by the minimum wage increase, and our membership is very excited about this contract. They're going to vote to ratify it, and hopefully it'll be a strong yes vote.
Well, so, thanks. Thank you. That wasn't meant to even embarrass you. I just didn't understand. So now for the department. So we heard from Ms. Shevaleva.
Senator Abel, can I interrupt you for a second?
Oh, yeah. Maybe you can. You're the chair.
I can?
Yeah.
Whenever I remember
just
one time.
Like, start talking.
Do you guys realize last year he actually cut me off one time in a thing? Do you remember that,
Senator? Chair was more than once.
He said he told me to do something, and then he cut me off just more than once. But I think at this conversation, Mr. Best, maybe you got room to get Mr. Best up here to ask in lieu of that conversation,
yeah.
You know where you're going with that? Because I'm trying to check. No, you're
yield to the chair.
I'm going to yield back to you. Then I just wanted to get Mr. Best up here to get his input on something too. So go ahead, Mr. Senator Abler.
Okay, it was multiple times I cut you off. So Ms. Shevely, so to whoever, probably the department, but so Ms. Shevelyva said that pretty much her whole crew is getting 14 and a quarter to maybe 15 and a quarter, and to get them up to the, and I don't want to, I mean the wages and rates matters, it matters to the SEIU contract because there are people at different rates, but if a group is always at the same rate, then to get them up to the wage that they're all supposed to be at, then they're identical. And so how can it be, you saw their chart, I'm sure, how can it be that they didn't get enough money to fully fund moving people from their 14 and a quarter to $19, et cetera, in their calculations? Because it seems pretty obvious to me that they don't have enough raw money even to get the people up to that number to give them all the money. So can you explain that, please?
Ms. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Senator Abler, yes, I think that because we do it on the aggregate across the entire population, and we're talking about 28,000 workers, the actual impact to each individual provider will really vary based on what they pay right now. So that particular provider's experience may be different than another's. I would also say that the wage floor in the SEIU agreement, again, only covers about a quarter of PCAs. And so to the extent that a provider is has traditional PCA, they're not required to pay that minimum wage. They're only tied to that 72.5 requirement in law on the aggregate.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Abler.
So I think I'm understanding. So it's not your intention as a governor, department, whoever. I don't even know who runs the place. But anyway, this invisible behind the curtain people, it's not their intention that the non-PCA workforce would achieve $19 an hour.
Ms. Bailey.
Chair Hoffman, Senator Abler, there is nothing requiring them to pay that level. Now, we apply the rate increase to the whole program, and the hope is, from the department's perspective, that PCAs, regardless of whether union membership, get paid more and those agencies are able to compete for workers compared to every other industry that they're competing with. But they're not required to pay at that minimum wage in the SEIU bargaining agreement.
I just ask another one.
Senator Abel.
Mr. Best, so what's the, we asked Ms. Shevaleva about the range of her employees. Do your employees get paid a range, or are they all at the same rate?
Chair Hoffman, Senator Abler.
Mr. Best.
We have a minimum. We pay the same wages and benefits to all employees. Doesn't matter if your choice or traditional, and that's the minimum of 1525 to that question. The rare exception to that is employees who are working overtime. We still have people in St. Paul that are working 70 hours a week at 1350. So when you look at the total number of those 70 hours, it's actually like $16 an hour is what they're receiving for that. So it's we're not doing what the department thinks we're doing. And there's a lot of, and I know there's a lot of other providers like us as well. So
this is not the first time, Senator Abler. How can we get to, I mean, I was one of those folks who was up for 17 hours. And it was my duty to say roll call. And because of that, we're able to say, all right, this is such a great problem to have, people, because PCA's never had a spotlight on them until this year. It's like, yes, right? So how can we merge this synergy of what we know? And it was helpful. Thank you, Ms. Bailey, for explaining how your assumptions come into play based upon the aggregate and not necessarily that hourly thing. Because I still, for me, there's a delta between the rate, how much is the rate going, right, and not. And I think that's where my argument goes. And to hear and to see what, you know, I know Mr. Khalif, his numbers show that there's just no way that we have a system sustainable based upon the fact that the market's say, look, you know, you're going to pay us at this rate, otherwise I'm going to go over here kind of thing. That's where my mind is going on that, right? And so how much money do we need in this committee to make this a whole thing? And maybe then the other thing to come up too, Mr. Best and Rick Farco and Ms. Bailey, like, is this now the time we start talking about inflation and we start putting, I mean, is this, and I don't know if I'm jumping the gun on this one, but it's like, how can we make this system whole right now going forward? And I think my mind is going on. I'm going to even spend the next 3 hours having this conversation, Senator Abler, but we're not going to. So,
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Abler, Senator Abler.
So this is helpful. So it just seems to me, if I can summarize, it seems as though the private side is pretty universally at one number, and the SEIU folks are different numbers for reasons that. And so that there's a, if the base gets high enough, they're all going to get a raise eventually. And I'm happy that they're getting paid.
Right, saying yes.
I supported that idea about the union and all that, so I'm totally cool with that. But I don't know how the private ones are not at a competitive disadvantage when there's no way that there's enough money in this, in the formula to get them up to that same base 19. And that's, did I say that right, Ms. Bailey? And it's not meant to be mean. I'm just trying to.
Yeah.
And finally, where's Mr. Monahan? We talked about rates, and last year our heads exploded as we were trying to get our hands around this. But I think the key difference here is the rates are quite universal and low, universally low in the one sector. And so if it's the policy decision from the department that they would be competitive, I think there's no way you can't give them enough money to get them to $19 at the same time as the other ones do. And I think that's going to cost some money. Is that, and you're here as the messenger, not as the person. I don't even know where the curtain is, Ms. Bailey.
No, that's funny. But that's, to your point, yeah, Senator Abler, it's the dollar amount. Does this dollar going to stretch it, right? And then the real question is, well, we know it's not going to, so how much more do we need to be asking for? I think it comes down to that. And then the other stuff, right? That's right, Senator Abler? So, Ms. Bailey, are we close?
Mr. Chair, Senator Abler, we believe we're fully funding the SEIU agreement. We also think the second question is, do you want to fully fund the rate framework in law?
Yep.
And those two things aren't necessarily separate. They can be married together, and we can work with the committee on providing technical assistance if that's your choice.
Mr.
Senator Abler, I think that is probably something we want to look at.
Well, and so it's the desire of the state or governor or whoever, somebody's desire that we would make Ms. Chevaliva and Mr. Best's business whole and the rest of them to that level. But it's not in the budget to do that. Is that fair to say?
Ms. Bailey.
Chair Hoffman, Senator Abler, I would say it is in the budget to fully fund the rate, to fully fund the SEIU agreement at the levels we agreed with.
Wait, no, I'm not. So I totally agree with that sentence.
Okay.
So I think SEIU, they seem really happy, and they're going to, I mean, they've, and there's some bonuses, and I think anything we can do to improve the career paths of these individuals who are, everyone I've met, SEIU or other, are just remarkable people dedicated to service. The people that do this are remarkable people trying to work the best they can. So I think I understand. And so the question that we have to ask is, can you let us know what it's going to take to bring the whole industry up to that level?
I think that's a fair question, Ms. Bailey.
That's
right?
Yes, Senator Abler, we can do that.
And then we're going to Senator Utke. That got to that. It took us 20 minutes to say, hey,
yes.
Ms. Bailey, could you give us an idea of what we need to have the rates at? So then that gives us our marching orders here. Not that I'm into marching bands, but I used to be. So go ahead, Senator Utke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I was going to dig into is just what came out, because I wanted to make sure that we had everybody on the same equal playing field, and needed to know that, because I thought I heard you say earlier that those in the bargaining unit versus those that were in the private market were all getting reimbursed the same. And then things kind of drifted a little bit, and I just want to make sure that there's equal treatment, you know, across the board, no matter who represents them and who they work for.
Yeah,
is that true?
Yeah, Senator Utke, that's on the whole thing about fully funding the SEIU agreement, correct? Fully funding across the board. No, that's going to be up to us to find, and we're going to ask technical assistance on what that difference is, and that's how I understand that. And they've got nobody shaking their head no at me on that. But yeah, so this is where I think we needed to be, because it's going to have to cost us as a Senate some more money in order to make that fully whole. I'm getting you versus that.
Right. So we need to know that, because they need equal treatment, because they're doing equal work.
Yeah, and I'm glad we're here having this conversation. This absolutely fills me with joy that we're even having this conversation, and that we're talking about a $4.52 per unit reimbursement rate thing here. So I want to thank you three. Is there any other comments? So we're good technical assistance. Thank you very much for explaining the assumptions. And I don't think am I missing anything else on a question on that? We'll get those numbers, and then we'll start working. The three of us, all of us, will work together in that, including you and you, right? Including everybody. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. And I learned a lot, and I appreciate that. Any final comments, questions? Nope. Kevin, what's up for us? Monday, we got a couple bills being heard. And
five
bills are going to be heard in this body on Monday. So you think we can do that in less than 2 hours? All right, I will be the time watch on that. Thank you very much, everybody. We are adjourned.